by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, low-grade living beings like bugs and mosquitoes suck the blood of human beings and other animals. Such insignificant creatures are unaware that their bites are painful to the human being. However, first-class human beings, brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas, are developed in consciousness, and therefore they know how painful it is to be killed. A human being endowed with knowledge certainly commits sin, if he kills or torments insignificant creatures who have no discrimination. The Supreme Lord punishes such a man by putting him into the hell known as Andhakupa. Where he is attacked by all the birds and beasts, reptiles, mosquitoes, lice, worms, flies, and any other creatures he tormented during his life. They attack him from all sides, robbing him of the pleasure of sleep. Unable to rest, he constantly wanders about in the darkness. Thus, in Andhakupa, his suffering is just like that of a creature in the lower species. Srila Prabhupada's purport. From this very instructive verse, we learn that lower animals, created by the laws of nature to disturb the human being, are not subjected to punishment. Because the human being has developed consciousness, however, he cannot do anything against the principles of Varnashrama Dharma without being condemned. Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita 4.13, Chatur Varnyam Maya Srishtam Gunakarma Vibhagashaha. According to the three modes of material nature and the work ascribed to them, the four divisions of human life were created by me. Thus all men should be divided into four classes, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishyas, and Shudras, and they should act according to their ordained regulations. They cannot deviate from their prescribed rules and regulations. One of these states that they should never trouble any animal, even those that disturb human beings. Although a tiger is not sinful if he attacks another animal and eats its flesh, if a man with developed consciousness does so, he must be punished. In other words, a human being who does not use his developed consciousness but instead acts like an animal surely undergoes punishment in many different hells. So this verse begins by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord. Ishvara upakalpita vrittinam. Vritti means of livelihood. Has been arranged by the Supreme Lord. So everyone, every living entity is given his sustenance by the laws of God. So, actually, by God's law, you and I are mosquito food, or food for lice, or the parasites that come inside the intestines. We're their designated sustenance. That's Krishna's law. And although they cause us pain and suffering by thus taking their share, their allotted quota, they're not held responsible for that. It says here, they are unaware that their bites are painful to the human being. the tapeworm that's in someone's intestines, for example, may do so much damage to that living entity, but he doesn't know what he's doing. Or the mosquito that bites, they don't know what kind of suffering they're causing. So they're not subjected to punishment. This is their regulation, and it's given to them by God. This is what you're supposed to, how you're supposed to live. And actually, they don't deviate from their vritti, from their way of life. They pretty much follow. You'll not find that they go astray. You'll never see that bumblebees go on strike. They always work hard. They don't overthrow the queen, you know. They follow. So Prabhupada says, because the human being has developed consciousness, however, he cannot do anything against the principles of Varnashram Dharma without being condemned. Now you wonder, how did Varnashram Dharma suddenly get into this purport, which is about, you know, what happens to you when you unnecessarily hurt other living beings? Because the principle is, just as the life, the way of life is ordained, the vritti, the means of livelihood, is ordained for all these creatures, so it is also ordained for human beings. And how is it ordained? Here it says, Chaturvarnya maya srishtam guna karma vibhagashaha. Krishna says, I've established the way of life for the Brahmana, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, and the Shudra. These human beings, they're divided into these four groups, and they each have their vritti, their authorized means of livelihood, how they're supposed to live as far as their economic sustenance, what work they do. They also have their rules and regulations. So with the animals, it's built in, like hardwired in. You know, what the beavers, in order to know how to be beavers, they don't have to get the beaver manual of instruction. They know what to do. They don't even go to beaver school. You know, it's pretty much instinctively they learn. So they build their dams and flood their ponds and build their lodges underwater, and they do the whole thing. And they chop down the trees, you know, they chew down the trees. And they live like that. And so all the living entities, they have their expertise, their mystic potency. Prabhupada called it like that, mystic potency. They can hover in the air. They can jump, like a flea. Choom, you know, and, feats of strength, like ants. They pick up something weighs 25 times the amount of their own body, you know, which humans can't do, even though they try. It's easily done by an ant. So anyway, they have their own. Skills, and it's given. It's just hardwired in. But for the human being, you need the software. You need the Vedas, because it's a life of consciousness. And so therefore, one has to deliberately follow. You have the chance to deviate from the prescribed rules and regulations. Hardly that's available for a cow, you know. Cows, they do their cow thing, and they can't become hippies or anything. I just have to be like cows. But a human being, there's so many ways to deviate. In fact, most of cultural anthropology, sociology, political science, and history is studies of ways of deviating. So, this is our human potential. So for them, the animals, they when as part of their vritti, is they can kill and cause pain to others. They're not held responsible. They don't know. But the vritti for a human being, his prescribed duty, his path, the things that he is to take up and to do, they're rules. So here it says, here for the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they cannot unnecessarily cause harm. We're supposed to understand that when some other living entity is killed, what's going on? We're not supposed to be ignorant that this is another living entity, that it's suffering, that it has a right to live, that it has even a right to its prescribed food, and so on. So we have to act according to ordained regulations. So you can see this Andakupa must be filling up fast. People are being attacked by all the birds, beasts, reptiles, mosquitoes, lice, worm, flies, and everything else that they end up tormenting in their life. People do this, you know, children, they like to do that sometimes, tear the wings off of flies just to see what happens. Standard, throw caterpillars on fires and do like that. Do things with frogs and so on. So then people go on and of course they carelessly kill in order to eat or whatever, anything, any reason for their convenience. Without any regard for other living entities. So that punishment is there. This chapter is a very difficult chapter to read, actually. First time I read it, it was funny. but now I find it, I'm not amused at all by this chapter. And the sooner we get finished with it, the happier I'll be. So we're now in the pits. This is like the bottom of the universe. This is the lowest of the low, you know. In human society, just in our condition, we see that there's heaven and hell just on this earth. A professor at the University of Pennsylvania wrote a book on the actual class system in America. And the highest class he called upper out of sight, and the lowest class he called lower out of sight. That is, you don't see them. The really, really rich people are invisible. You don't see their houses from the road. Neither do they display their wealth for two reasons. They don't need to. In other words, somebody who's just made $1 million wants to let everybody know, and therefore he's got this vulgar diamond ring on his little finger and drives some ostentatious car so everybody can see, hey, I'm rich, you know, somebody like Donald Trump or somebody. But the people who have had the money for generations and generations, they don't need to do this. So they don't flash it around. The really rich people, you won't notice, they drive a 2-year-old Oldsmobile station wagon. You know. You don't see them. And I said their houses you don't even see from the roads. You just see a little, you know, private road going off somewhere. They said they may have very, very large, spacious houses, but they don't like you. They don't flash it around. It's too much of an invitation for kidnappers, blackmailers, things like that, you know. So the upper classes is upper out of sight. You don't see them. And same with the very lower, the lower out of sight. They're in prisons, mental hospitals, old age homes. They're institutionalized. Because they're a little more visible. That's why there's so much disturbance right now. Is because 10 years ago or so, the government let all these people out of mental hospitals, people that weren't dangerous. So that's now why we have this big, you know, homeless problem. Part of the reason, anyway. Because these people who used to be out of sight are now a little bit more visible. And so people are more upset about it. But usually they're incarcerated away, and this is the lowest class. They're in prisons, mental hospitals, caretaking homes, gulags, lagers, prison camps, concentration camps, whatever have you going on. So you don't see them so much. So same in the universe, you know, there's higher and lower regions. And just like here on this planet, so you see heavens and hells, and there's the upper out of sight and the lower out of sight. So there's the upper out of sight, you know, in the universe, the region of Brahman, sages like that. So here's like the lower out of sight, the hellish planets. Nobody wants to visit there. There are no tourists come to see. It's not good at all, but there it is. So this is our tour through inexpressible amounts of suffering and difficulty. So it's there, you can just in this planet you see people situated everywhere, fortunate and unfortunate. So also it's going on in this wider scale, bigger scale also. You take the most hellish place on earth and you just make it the totality of existence, and here you have these hells. Things a whole lot worse with unrelieved, you know, suffering like this. And similar, we have our heavenly places, wherever, you know, Bel Air, or I don't know, whatever those places are, which are very, very nice and pleasant, and everyone's pretty, and everyone has money, and there's no visible suffering. But well, that's the state of things. So this is the arrangement that when people don't act properly, when they transgress the laws of God, they're punished. That's why there's so much suffering. The laws of God are there. They're established, and you transgress, then there's punishment. No way around that. And some people, they go on and on and on. And so they end up in this hellish planet. So why do we have to have such a disturbing tour? Well, because you will see in the next chapter the reaction that Maharaj Parikshit has to this. He's so upset by it. And he wants to know, how can people be delivered from this conditions? And Shukadeva Goswami says, well, by atonement, prayaschita. This is like an atonement. So you see this, you commit some sinful activity, and then you are punished. So then the atonement is there. But he wants to know, then what's to keep people from then again committing some sinful activity? So he said this atonement is just like an elephant's bathing. As soon as the elephants come out of the river, they roll around in the dust again, get a nice soothing coat of mud on their bodies. So again, you become. So he's concerned that how can these people be delivered from this hellish condition, especially from suffering like this, this unmitigated suffering. So it seems hard to us, you know. I forgot who it was. I was making the point in class the day before. I don't know which day. How it doesn't look like they're doing something so bad, you know. Was that you, Hari Ashra? You know, they're sitting there and they're dressed up in their dinner jackets and the candlelight is there and the waiter is serving out their lobster, which is one of those things, you know, when they cook lobster, you put it in a pot of cold water alive and then turn on the heat. And that's literally the thing that gets boiled alive, especially lobster, as I recall. I think I seem to recall a member somewhere sitting in some kitchen somewhere and listening to the animals scratching at the pot, you know, as the heat goes up. And everybody just, you know, I think nothing was happening while this lobster is in agony. And just really being completely oblivious. I remember one devotee told me he had gone to, started out and going to agricultural school. And he had a course on growing pork, I mean pigs, you know, pork. And so the whole class was there, and there's this, you know, pig that was there in the classroom. And so the instructor was going to show them how you tested the pig to see if it was ready for harvest, you know, for slaughtering. You know, the pork had to have a certain amount of fat and everything. And what you do is you take this device and shove it into the pig and pull out a plug of its flesh so you can look at it, you know. So he described how this guy was describing this and quietly went over to this pig, you know, and just ran this thing into him. The pig, of course, freaks out. You know, and everybody just like pretends like it's not happening, you know. Like this pig isn't going crazy with pain while this, you know, big tube is being shoved through his body. You know, so they can pull out a plug of its flesh, you know. It was the same experience as sitting in this kitchen while this lobster is crawling, you know. And if you're a kid, you know, you know what's happening. You know, somehow or other, you know that there's this animal in there trying to get out like crazy. And all the adults are like, just like it's not there. And so he described it as the same way, you know, digging this plug of flesh out of this pig who was gone crazy. And just like it was an inanimate object or something. You know, like they were slicing off a piece of a pear, you know. That's how they were treating it. So this is what you get punished for, you know. They do the same thing unnecessarily with animals in laboratories. You know, they really want to pretend like these animals don't undergo so much suffering. And I want to speak of, slaughtering the animals. I just read a review of some book. Somebody had written a book about a farm, and they talked about the necessary cruelty of animals. The guy had watched this. It was a pig farmer again. He watched what everything did, and he said something about how horrible it was, but it was he used the word necessary. Now that's the word they stick in there, necessary. You know, it's totally unnecessary to do like this. So anyway, it's a little overwhelming when you see what the kind of punishments that are there for these people that are doing these things, which to them is a normal part of their everyday life. And you think, well, how can this, you know, how can this, so much suffering is there? So a devotee, we should actually feel very concerned for these people. If you see a person, you should just think of, you know, what's Actually, we should be able to see a person's future. May not be able to see their past. Actually, you can see their past too. If you know the present very well, you can see both the past and the future. And so if you see a person's present activities, you can tell what that person's future is. So they don't know. They think everything is fine and dandy and that they're doing all these things. And, you know, when it's all over, I'll be finished and I won't have to. There'll be no, you know, I'll just be obliterated, so I won't be around to suffer any consequences. But we should know better. We have to see, you know, through eyes of Scripture or through knowledge. So with that, you can see all these people, they have a very negative prognosis in life. Very, very, very bad. So we have to save them. We have to have some compassion, or to speak of compassion for their victims. And do it, make every effort we can. These people can get off of this this path. Ultimately, we have to actually recreate human society, establish this dharmas, varnashram dharma for everybody, so that they know how to act. Here, Prabhupada has given us the book of knowledge, which teaches us how to behave. He told us, he says, I've given you everything. So we have it here. Everything we need to know. And for organization of human life, not just for running some little religious institution or keeping a group of reclusive monks or nuns off somewhere, but actually for total reformation of human society. So everything is there. All knowledge is there. But we have to be able to receive it. It's all in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. But there's a saying that a book is like a mirror. If an ass looks in, an angel won't look out. So we also have to follow the process of Krishna consciousness. And if we read Srimad Bhagavatam, hear it, ready to surrender to Krishna and do His will and becoming purified, then we'll see so many instructions are there for us that we can't even understand now or don't even notice. I don't see it's there. Layers and layers for implementing this plan to save people. And so gradually that has to be implemented. That's our mission in life. Otherwise, as we see, gradually even this planet is becoming more and more hellish. It's like all the institutionalized people are on the streets. So you'll see more and more, you know, crowding everywhere. And these kinds of hells will be manifest before us. Okay, I guess that's what I have. It's very hard to talk about all this stuff. Any questions or comments? Yeah. There seems to be two systems. There's transmigrating, say, in the earthly region to 8,400,000 species of life here or in the subterranean heavenly planets anyway. And I'd say the heavenly planets, that business. And then there's actually these hellish planets. So I don't know how these two systems interface exactly. I've never heard it described anywhere. Exactly what happens. what causes a person to say I do something sinful. So what's the difference between, say, taking birth in a worm in a stool here on this earth, or they're going to one of these hellish planets? That's, I guess, is your question, something like that. I can only imagine, well, I just imagine that Yamaraj knows how to deal things out in proportionate ways. But here it says that if you do these things, you go to these hellish planets. And it says if you do these things, you also take birth in these lower species of life. So I always I kind of assumed it was both and. You know, 10,000 years on Undakupa and then another, you know, 50 lifetimes in somebody's intestinal tract or whatever, and then you're paid off. I always just assumed this is some kind of, and people know how to set the punishment, but I've never seen anybody discuss, you know, exactly how it's done. Why one, when one starts or another starts. Anyway, it's pretty gross, that's all I can say. And it seems really horrible to us because we're just so used to people being so flagrantly sinful, just as a matter of course, you know. You see all the people going into McDonald's, you know, and, you know, you think, God, you know, how can all these people be punished like this? But, you know, we're seeing like a really horrible sample of human life, too. This is Kali Yuga. And these things just weren't done. They just weren't done. Yeah. I mean, after all, when you saw that through the authority of the state, certain things that are like murder, and just like in Germany, they had the concentration camps, Vernichtungslagers, extermination camps, and it was just it was the good thing to do, you know, purifying the human race by gassing all these Jews and feeding them into crematorium. I mean, that was like, you know, the right thing to do. People were doing it because they were become convinced by the authorities, by the state, that these people may look like human beings, but they're really not. They're kind of parasites on the human race, and they're contaminating everything. And we just have to, you know, this is like our great purification. Get rid of them. And it was normal. You know, it was like that's what people were doing. Day in and day out, you know. That's all you could see. If you're in the middle of one of these things, that's what was happening. The whole state was organized to do it. People didn't think it was wrong. It was right. And it seemed normal. So to so many people, the idea of killing a child in the womb seems normal. It seems right. Doesn't seem anything. You can get used to practically anything. Just because you're used to it and it seems normal doesn't mean it's normal. So things are so far deviated it seems like extreme punishments for very little, you know, common everyday things. But they're not common everyday things. Yeah. I mean, after I became a devotee, it was a long time, 3 or 4 years passed, where I ever found myself. What happened was, actually, is when I go home and visit my parents, actually, they wouldn't even eat meat while I was in the house, you know. They wouldn't even do it. So I didn't, you know, 2 or 3, 4 years passed before I actually saw anybody eat meat, you know. And then I went to this engagement at Haverford College. And part of it was I was supposed to go to some dinner afterwards. And I don't know, I went to and got some fruit or something. And then I sat down, and this guy across, you know, talking to him, professor at Haverford College, And in fact, he was saying, he asked me if I had seen so-and-so's latest book called The Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object. And while he was talking like this, and I was trying to pretend nothing was happening, he was like slicing up this roast beef on his plate, you know, this big raw slab of roast beef. And I hadn't seen anything like that, you know, for 3 years. And I've been, you know, and it was all I could do, you know, to keep from running screaming from the room, you know, that this guy was doing this right in front of me. And everybody was going on just like nothing was happening, you know. Well, now I'm used to it. I've grown, you know, a little to where I just like, you know, because enough times I end up in these situations, you know, where somebody's, you know, ripping the wings off of an animal or something. And you just have to kind of tolerate it, you know. Don't look at it. But that first experience, you know, was just like, I was horrified. It was just like a horror movie or something, you know. And like some scene out of Marquis de Sade or something, you know, to me. So, you know, when you're not used to it, then you really see it, you know. I remember this guy, and he, oh, you read so-and-so's Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object. He saw it in his roast beef. Yeah. It's just a result of becoming Krishna conscious is gradually you begin to feel more and more compassion for other people. Part and parcel of Krishna. I mean, Krishna wants us to feel, and Lord Chaitanya said to save him. Of course, and we may do so just on orders of higher authorities. Well, I don't really care. But I just go out there because I'm told. But actually, just by the development of Krishna consciousness, these feelings start to arise that how much people are suffering. And actually, by your own experience, you don't have to, it doesn't take much to see. The material world is really good at looking good. And people are really amazing at their ability to put on a good show for themselves and for other people. When you really find out what's going on, you know, it's so horrifying. We're in so many illusions about the material world. One is that. Is that our own institution, ISKCON, is very messed up, but that the Karmis have it together in their institutions. And that means that people have not had any experience at all working with, you know, anything like the post office or a university department or the military or a business. I mean, the extent to which these institutions are screwed up and staggering from day to day is amazing. Just amazing. And the only reason they don't fall apart totally is that there's just so much wealth around, at least in this country, you know. There's so many cushions that they can fall on. But, you know, this is just like a total illusion that it's together. So anyway, so there's a certain amount of naivete, or that people are actually, you know, not having a good time. Of course, if devotees are desiring some sense gratification, then actually they may be envious of the materialists. They're wanting to have some sense gratification. And they don't see them as having a hellish time at all. They get to go out on dates, they get this, they get that, you know, whatever. And then actually they may be envious. So then it's very hard to preach to them, to have compassion. Because you feel that they're in better shape than you are. People who have material desires, therefore, don't make good preachers, because there's no conviction that... Because when you preach to somebody, you're saying, you know, you should become like me. But if my inner desire is to become like you, it's going to be very hard to preach with any kind of conviction like that. So that if that there, that desire for sense gratification is there, then you'll never see the material world for what it is. You know, and because you won't be able to see, when you want sense gratification, you stop to be able to see the incredible price you pay for that little bit of pleasure. The incredible price you pay just to have this thought, I am the enjoyer. I am the controller. Yeah. Well, let's come back to you. Okay, go ahead, Manasika. You need your hand up first. Yeah, and it's blowing everybody's mind that nothing is happening to them. They thought, hey, I thought we were, you know, I thought this was America, you know. Yeah, right. And, yeah, I thought you had your hand up. You're just stretching. Okay. You did something. Yeah. Well, it depends on what your service is. You know, it depends on what your service is. If you're doing, if that killing that you do is going on in the service of Krishna, Vasudev Dad in his condition actually had no more use for his body. So, he let them eat. But as long as we have some use for our body in Krishna's service, then we have to maintain it properly. But when we have no more use for it, if it's too far gone, then you know. And if you're not attached. So actually, saintly persons do this. All over the world, actually. There's stories of Christian saints, same things, you know. They have this realization that they're not their bodies. They have no attachment to it. It's completely useless. So they don't care. They see these little maggots as God's little creatures doing their thing. So because they're completely attached, so they're not thinking, this bug is eating, this maggot is eating my body. It's not on that platform. So if you're on that platform, that's another thing. But anyway, we have a use for our body in Krishna's service. So even if we are that detached, we still take care of it. That's not why we're doing it, of course. We're attached, but anyway. Still, the principle is it's all right. Krishna service. Because, you know, it's not like, you know, now that you're in the service of God, you're 007, you know? You can't die. But it goes along with your territory, you know? If you're a Kshatriya, if you're a Vaishya, if you're a Brahmana, you have different restrictions. So that depends what your prescribed duties are. But certainly this idea that, you know, now I'm in the service of God, therefore I'm beyond the rules and regulations, and therefore I can do anything, that's as bogus as you come. Krishna specifically states in the Bhagavad Gita that those that are beyond the rules and regulations follow them anyway. Just to set an example for everybody else. And he cites as himself as one of the persons that does this. So it's never been, you know, you never get a license for violence or sense gratification. You see, you can't dovetail sense gratification. People who want to say that now I'm a devotee, I can do anything, I can kill anything, you know, or commit crimes. Basically, that sense gratification, you know, the idea, say, to go out and steal, is one very powerful way of making the statement that I am the enjoyer, I'm the controller. Right? One of the most powerful ways of making that statement. Above the laws, nobody can tell me what to do. You know, I can take anything because it all belongs to me. So that stealing is an act of sense gratification. And a lot of people steal not because they, you know, it's one thing if, you know, you're starving and you steal a potato. I'm talking about people who steal, you know, just not out of total necessity. It's what it is. It's sense gratification. So if